It's described so intensely and horrifically just right there that I might have nightmares, man.
To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people.
Because history has shown us that courage can be contagious. And hope can take on a life of its own.
I will bring you hope, Bertha. And I ask only one thing in return.
We move now, together.
Not at all. Hope is not lost today. It is found.
Hope is what keeps you going.
Even if the whole world is telling you to move, it is your duty to plant yourself like a tree, look them in the eye, and say no. You move.
Welcome to Reading Rangers.
I can't believe this. Trapped in Riovel's basement with a sex-starved teenage werewolf.
I'm Paul.
I'm Kate.
And I'm Trish.
And today on Reading Rangers, we're continuing our Lower McMaster Bujold Miles Wolkosigan series with three novellas smushed together with a framing story called, after the third novella, Borders of Infinity. Consists of three novellas, The Mountains of Mourning, Labyrinth, and Borders of Infinite.
Should we talk about all of them together, or should we break this up into each story?
Unless we can find things that snag in between each story, and there's not a lot. I mean, the frame story is, not much. I think we can take them in order of the book. Start with Mountains, go through Labyrinth, and end with Borders. So who remembers the stories well enough to give an overall summary of what's going on in these stories?
I just read them again today, so I can take a stab at it.
Go for it.
Mountains of Mourning. Young Miles is on leave at his family's country and comes across a bedraggled-looking hill woman who's trying to gain admittance to the ground. And decides, kind of on a whim, kind of just to tweak the guard that won't listen to her, to cut her to the head of the line, as it were. She's got a grievance, and she's wanting to speak to the Lord, and so Miles decides to show off and help her, and winds up hoist on his own petard when his father not only decides to help her, but decides that the best way to help her is to have Miles help her. So next thing we know, Miles and a bodyguard and a doctor are traveling by horseback to the hill village where this woman, Hara, hails from to help her prosecute her husband for the murder of her deformed baby. The culture of Bariar is infamous for killing deformed children, not allowing them to survive to grow up. And of course, since Miles is often perceived as a mutant due to the circumstances of his own birth, to remind listeners who might not remember, assassins tried to poison his parents while his mother was pregnant, and the poison they used resulted in birth defects. Miles is genetically sound, but he has brittle bones and he looks like a dwarf. And his own grandfather was hell-bent on not letting him survive, as he would obviously bring shame to their family. Miles later won him over, of course, because Miles was just awesome even when he was 5 years old. But so Miles is uniquely sympathetic to the plight of this poor baby that was murdered. So he goes up, he lords it over the speaker and forces him. The speaker is like the local, would you say a judge?
Headman.
Not quite a judge, the headman of the village. And wants to, by God, start his investigation. But first, the woman's husband has to be found. And the headman really, really is reluctant to comply and tries to stall him in lots of ways. And finally, Miles forces him to comply and send out men to find him. And,
we ultimately discover the husband was not the murderer of the baby.
Right. after he's interrogated with that fast penta. He didn't murder. He has made Miles promise not to ask him about anything except for the murder of the baby, because he really doesn't want to be the one that gives up who did it. But Miles figures out by clues and observation who actually did. And the murderer is Hera's own mother, who is an old-fashioned kind of hill gal. And when she's put under the fast penta, confesses that she killed several of her own babies before Hera was born.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, it's a really minor deformity. It's what we usually call a hair lip, which is easily corrected by surgery. And I've known lots of people that were born with it, and you can't tell once they've had the surgery as babies. You wouldn't even know. But this woman has murdered her own children. Hera was the only one of her children that she allowed to survive because Hera was beautiful. And while Hera was off gathering berries and her husband was off looking for her, Grandma went in and done killed the baby. And Miles graciously decides to let her live, but he puts her on under a sentence that's as bad as if she died. So she can't own property. She is completely under her daughter's supervision, and she has to live the rest of her life with that sense of guilt and essential non-personhood. And Miles ends his story at the grave of the little baby, and he decides that he is going to be her white knight forevermore, just as an ordinary hero has a great lady he serves, or someone that he does things in her name. This baby, whose name was Raina, shall be his.
And he helps out the mother and father and starts to try to change the culture of the backcountry.
Yeah, he sets up the mom to go to school to become a teacher, and her husband is a carpenter, and he's like, well, why don't you go with her? You can get work building, and you might learn some more of your trade. And yeah,
come back and help.
Part of him wanted to stay there himself and live with those people, but he realizes that the investment his society has placed in his training and education gives him a larger responsibility than just one village.
With great power comes great responsibility.
Right. So that was a really nifty story. It was very sobering, kind of sad, and it was Miles at what Alex likes to call his most space Nancy Drew, even though it's on his own planet. And continuing the theme of breaking our heart with animal abuse, Miles has this horse called Fat Ninny.
Yeah.
And Bujold really, really, really drives home how beloved this horse is and how delightful this horse is. And it's his grandfather's last horse that the grandfather bred and trained to take care of Miles. And so, of course, there's a nasty scene where someone has tried to kill the horse. And it made me really sick. How about you guys?
Yeah. I'm not the super horse lover like, say, Judith Tarr is, but even less. I winced like, oh no, the last horse, you did not. Yes, you did. I had not remembered that detail from the last time I read the story. I remembered, oh, yep, this is the murder mystery, and I knew I'd done it, but I had forgotten details like the attempt on the horse. It's like, oh crap,
oh,
that
man.
Really strikes at the heartstrings.
Yes, I thought that was very affecting. Very well done. And one thing that also impressed me was when Ma Kashurik, the wife of the speaker, mutters just loud enough for Miles to hear, all that for a horse, after Dr. Dia gets out his med kit and stitches up the horse, anesthetizes the horse, stitches up its neck, and put some kind of bandage and everything on it. So she's very envious because this is more medical care than she usually sees any human get, and that just drives home how isolated and backward this place is. So even that incident, done for the emotional impact, is also used for the world building, which I thought, you know, is just one of the many great little details that that McMaster Bujold drives home.
And it reminds Miles of privilege too, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Yeah. Which I think is the whole point of this story, is him realizing just what it means to be a Vor and be that privilege.
And yet shows how slightly different the Vorkazigans are from other Vorns. Like, they have this fiefdom, but it's not the greatest. It's a backwards hill country of superstitious people who are still living centuries in the past. I mean, his father insists, nope, you're not going to go fly in there. That would be wrong. You're going to go ride into these mountains and hills and meet them on their own terms. And Miles just really does not having. I mean, I was reminded of the scenes back earlier in Barry Yar when we had them hiding out in these hills. But here we actually, moving from place to place and trying to stay ahead of the pretender. And here we have Miles going into that same sort of country, and we get to see what these people are like decades later. And in many cases, while the planet itself has changed a lot and the cities have changed, these people haven't, and Miles has to come to terms with he's the feudal overlord of people who think that he's a mutant and would have killed him at birth if they could.
Yeah.
I think this is a really strong story because it really brings home the vulnerability Miles has right on his home turf.
Well, and that's another theme that ties all three of these together, is each time Miles is kind of thrown on his own resources and has to think his way out of an almost unsolvable problem.
With his father, you know, Miles thinks, oh, my father is setting me another test, and perhaps he is, but it's also part of Errol's lifelong campaign to help raise up the people of his district and of Barriar by every means he can find, every tool he can use, including his own son, to open his people's eyes. I just thought that was also pretty striking.
And it's a very subtle plan, the way, you know, he's taking advantage of a very organic situation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. The more I get into these, the more the Vorkosigans remind me of the Atreides. And so I'm getting to like them more and more.
That's a good comparison between the Vorkosigans and the Atreides, since I recently reread Dune. So the Atreides, who are always on my mind, are even more recently online. I hesitate to say the word good aristocrats, good feudal overlords, because I mean, there's still problems with the whole idea of a feudal society. But as far as at least trying to give a damn about the people they're sworn to rule and protect, yeah, the Vorkosigans are pretty near the top. I mean, there's not much. But I mean, the emperor is a good ego, though we haven't really seen him to this point in the series in any sort of real power. I mean, he's mostly been a pawn and just only recently coming out of people's shadows.
Right. In the text of The Mountains of Mourning, Miles keeps thinking of Gregor as poor, pale Gregor. it's a contradiction between, you know, in some other stories, he's thinking of Gregor as his, you know, childhood occasional playfellow. But here in this story, Gregor is still very remote. They have not come back to friendship yet here.
Oh, so this is kind of before Miles' adventure with the incognito Gregor from the book we read? Because wasn't it just last book?
Wait, no, is this after the Vor game? This is,
yeah.
Because he's back with the mercenaries. So they've had the cake fight at the end of the Vor game. The verbal cake fight. So, yeah, it's a little weird for him to be going back to thinking of Gregor as remote.
I think it's a matter of her writing them out of order and forgetting where exactly they are in each other's timeline as far as what Miles thinks of the Emperor.
Right. But, I mean, it goes very well just concerning the story in itself, because now what he's fighting for is not Pale Gregor, but Reyna.
Right.
And that works extremely well thematically with the story.
It really, really does. Because there's a woman at the center of each of these stories, and each time it's in a very surprising way. So you might think it's all about Hera, because Hera is what brings him into the hill, but it's really Reyna here, just as it's not who we're expecting in the other two stories either.
That's a good point.
I guess there is a very thin sort of thematic thread here. I mean, I wasn't too thrilled with the whole "I'm lying on my back after surgery. And I'm going to tell Simon Illion these three stories." I was not impressed with that sort of framing device at all.
Well, it was kind of funny, just in that he was having to justify the cost overruns.
but this first story, he isn't even doing it. He's just thinking about it, which is really true. I mean, the cost overruns in Labyrinth and especially Borders of Infinity kind of makes sense. And listeners, we'll get to those in a moment. But yeah, here he just like kind of like remembered this before he started talking to Simon. He's like, "So why are you remembering this all of a sudden?" I mean, not that it's not an important part in Miles' life, but what does the Mountain's Mourning have to do with cost overruns?
Yeah, well, I think his devotion to Reyna definitely has an impact on what happens in the next story.
Yeah, well, Reyna goes to why he would never ever steal. Although I think, you know, even before that, his character was pretty well set. He might commit sins out of arrogance, but not out of greed. But one other thing I wanted to mention was that with a discussion of Barriar, where Errol, the regent, has to order the death of a son of an ally because of dueling. And, you know, he tries to find an alternative, but he just can't. And he and Cordelia vow to make this a kinder world for their children. And then when Miles is faced with a difficult, with a homicide murder trial and has to pass sentence on it, he comes up with this alternative where she's sentenced to death, but the death is suspended in fact, and she's only legally dead. So Cordelia and Errol have helped to contribute to a world where an idea like that is possible. And so you can see Barriar has become a little kinder, because this is the thing that Miles can do and carry out, and yet they're all still traditional enough that this hypothetical death has real weight and gravitas. So I just thought that was fascinating.
That's an amazingly good point, Trish. I wasn't even thinking that far back. But yeah, I think of all of his adventures and things he's done, this is definitely what Cordelia would be the most proud of so far.
Yeah, I can't really add to that. I think that should stand as it is. That's really insightful, Trish. Thank you.
Thanks.
So let's move on to Labyrinth.
Oh man, I loved this.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite novels, because we get to meet Sergeant Tara at last, and Sergeant Tara is such a character.
Oh, so she's going to be in more stories?
She shows up in the background in a bunch more stuff, because, you know.
Cool.
She gets rank and comes to Dendari. Yep. So yeah. So I'll explain this briefly for listeners. So, under his Admiral Nadesmith persona, Miles goes to the infamous "We will sell and buy anything" planetary system of Jackson's Hole, which has a ton of wormhole rules and no morals in selling anything to anyone. Jackson's Hole is capitalism gone to the 25th power, and there's really no laws except what you can enforce at the end of a contract. And if you can, Miles is supposedly going to buy weapons, but he's really there to get Dr. Kanaba off of Jackson's Hole and get him to work for Barry R. Unfortunately, Dr. Kanaba has special genetic samples that he injected into a patient, and he's not going to leave without those. And so, into trying to get these samples, Miles humorously tries to break into this genetic lab and instead gets captured himself and thrown into the dungeons, ostensibly to be eaten by the monster. The monster turns out to be an 8-foot woman with superhuman strength, speed, claws, fangs.
The aforementioned teenage werewolf.
Aforementioned teenage werewolf.
Horny teenage werewolf.
Lonely teenage werewolf.
Lonely and feeling inhuman and in need of company teenage werewolf. Miles has to prove her humanity in a
tender
conjugal
way.
And then the two of them have to try to escape. In their first route goes wrong, but Miles figures out a good way to get revenge on the Baron and decides to defrost his collection. And then we get the long extended chasing where they're trying to get off the planet, while Miles is trying to convince all the parties in Jackson's Hole that they all betrayed each other, and Miles was just an innocent pawn in all this, and they should go be shooting each other instead, which shows Miles at his most
Milesian.
Really, yeah, wheeling, dealing, talking out of the bottom of the set. You think I was hired by your half brother? Oh, maybe I was, and if I was so, then you should be seeing him. It's like, I don't even know if Miles realizes what the actual thread of the story would actually be if he actually stopped about it for 5 minutes. By the end of this, he's got three of them chasing around their tails, and he's gotten away with the doctor, the genetic sample, and of course the horny teenage werewolf.
And this was actually, to me, the most kind of horrifying three story, because what's at the heart of Jackson's Hole, and I was born in the real Jackson Hole, and I don't know why they decided to name such a horrible place after one of the most beautiful spots in the country. But anyway, it's a really creepy form of human trafficking. So this Baron, how did we decide to pronounce his name?
Ryoval.
He doesn't kidnap people so much as he gets genetic samples of them, grows clones of them, and then enslaves the clones. They could be used as sex slaves or curiosities or whatever, and he could keep exploiting them forever, and that's what this giant freezer that Miles defrosts is full of, you know, more than a lifetime of samples of people that this guy is exploiting economically. And so, you know, he's really interested. There's this side character just for this novel who is a quote-unquote quaddy. Nicole has two pairs of arms and no legs. She was adapted for zero gravity, and she's a beautiful, wonderful, amazing musician. And so Ryoval is really interested in her, and he's really interested in Captain Bell Thorne, who is a hermaphrodite, a very talented one. And so at one point he bargains for what Miles needs. He's like, well, give me samples of yourself, Captain Thorne, and Nicole, and I'll give you the person who's going to be Torin, who is bred to be a super soldier, by the way. This was like a military experiment, and she was one of 10, and she's the only surviving one of a group of 10. But it's all about human trafficking, and I really like that the one who really gets mad about it is Belle. Belle is like, I will not condemn future clones of myself to this kind of servitude. No, no, no. And but it just creeped me out completely. It was terrible, and I might have actually cheered when Miles melted all the samples.
Yeah, ordinarily my instincts would all be about, you know, don't destroy the library of genetic samples, you know, don't destroy information. But here it's all twisted into slavery and horribleness. So yeah, I think it was great.
Yeah.
Now remind me, I forgot who has done what. Neither of you have read the series before, correct?
Oh, I've read the whole series, yeah.
Oh yeah, you have?
Okay. So I was just thinking of a certain character who we've not met. You know who I'm talking about.
Should I step away for a moment?
No, but
I just want to confirm for listeners that this whole idea of clones of people and the implications and are they the real person and what are done to them is something that's going to come back in a series changing way. This is kind of like our first taste into what Jackson's Hole is all about and what they can do as an entree to a later major novel and a major character that comes into that novel and goes forward from that novel.
Right.
Oh, so we're going to have to deal with these assholes again?
Yeah.
Yes.
Jackson's Hole is an incredibly rich storytelling environment.
Well, I can see where it would be, yeah.
And it definitely gets made use of at least a few more times.
all the way up to Captain Vorpital's Alliance.
Well, especially with all the chaos that Miles has left behind him, I can see where there's still lots of story to be told. Did this remind either of you... The whole thing is like, you know, we're helping a doctor defect with his life's work. It was very like William Gibson. And that just made me realize what we were really reading was a really good campaign of like Shadowrun or something.
The first
Bujold I felt like I could play. I really like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's no elves or shamans or anything, but right. Just the whole cyberpunk corporate human life is just a commodity to be bought and sold. That is Jackson's Hole. And so, yeah, you could definitely play a campaign around it.
Oh, yeah.
There is a old GURPS role-playing book, GURPS for Kosigan. It's actually written by the Invisible Library author, Genevieve Cogman. Back before she started doing novels, she wrote lots of role-playing stuff, including...
Oh, I didn't know she wrote that.
Cool.
Yes, she did.
I actually own that book, but I've never found anyone to play it with.
Oh, man. Well, maybe we should put that on our infinite list of...
Yes. Podcast. Absolutely.
That makes a lot of sense. We should definitely... That should be bumped up near the top. Because it thematically relates to reading Rangers now.
Yeah.
It does. So, yes. So shenanigans in and around Jackson's Hole are definitely something that the system and that book are really well designed to do. I mean, the book is very tilted towards Admiral Naismith sort of shenanigans. And this is, I mean, having things go wrong, getting captured, having to escape under less than ideal circumstances, making quick deals. Yeah, this is definitely a role-playing scenario gone with some really bad, horrible rolling and lots of improvisation by the main characters trying to get out of it.
There's another way to play?
No. Not run, anyway.
I will say, rereading this story bothered me slightly at the beginning when Belle's character was being described and they were talking about Baton hermaphrodites as being social consciousness run amok, and only the hyper-tolerant Batons were the place where the hermaphrodites could have a home, and it made me cringe just a little bit. I think Belle would be a slightly different character if written today.
The it pronouns also kind of grated on me. It's like, yeah, you wouldn't write like that today. This year. Yeah, Belle would be they, them for certain. We give credit to Bujold for having characters who are non-binary, but yeah, we've learned a lot since Belle first came on the stage.
Yeah, it almost felt like the switch from Belle kind of hitting on Miles to suddenly deciding that Nicole was the way to go. That almost felt like it was being played for laughs, but they got a happy ending, sort of. So...
Yeah, this is the first time we've heard about them. This is the first time I think we've seen Quaddies on screen.
It's the first time in the post-Cordelia verse, but I believe that Falling Free, which is the book about Quaddies, was actually written in the first three books that Lois wrote.
It was.
Although it was set 200 years before Vorkosigan-Vorkosiverse.
Right. It is the first time we've seen it on Reading Rages, the first time we've encountered them in the main Miles line.
Yes, that's right.
I don't recall them ever showing up again until Diplomatic Immunity, which is way down the line.
Well, this first representative was very striking and interesting. I kind of wish she'd gotten to be a little bit more of a character, but I did like the way she fought.
Yes. Yes.
Not to be messed with.
Mm-hmm. She knew her capabilities, and, you know, other people assumed that she would be weak and almost helpless, and she was not.
Dude, she kicked ass without even dropping her dulcimer.
Sweet combat music.
So she would be the party's bard, of course.
Oh, absolutely.
So that was lots of fun. I can't tell you how delighted I am that Tora is a recurring character, because, again, she felt almost for a little bit like she was just going to be the punchline to an elaborate joke. But then when he was like, no, you're going to become a mercenary and you're going to be a person and live your life, I was so happy. I was so happy. And that is Miles after he's learned the importance. I think Tora probably owes a lot to Reina.
One of the great things about this story in particular is how many threads in it I see going back and forward, and how connected the whole Vorkosiverse is. You know, the characters that seem to be just side characters that turn out to be important later, or have a backstory that you, the reader, know that other people don't. Throwaway lines like the stuff about the genetic material that Dr. Kanaba talks about, that there was a trail of death behind this material, and I know, you know, what that's from because I've read Ethan of Athos, but you know, it's hardly, you know, it's just, you know, two lines or so in the story, and it brings all this other stuff. And, you know, as Paul has been saying, the characters who are in this story who appear again, most of the important characters in this story, and even the side characters, are going to show up again sooner or later in what could just be a bottle story.
Well, it works very well as a bottle story.
Mm-hmm.
But it's neat to find that it really is.
Right.
Okay, so are we ready to tackle our third novella?
Oh, sure. Borders of Infinity. Wow.
A.K.A. Stalag 17. So, this is Borders of Infinity. Miles gets himself thrown into a Setagandan prison camp in order to try to get a single person out, but in so doing, he finds out just how horrible the camp is. He's stripped of everything, including his dignity at one point, and basically has to engineer a revolution to take over the camp and engineer mass escape. And we get to see Miles work from absolutely nothing to basically take over an entire camp and pull one over on the Setagandans. I mean, it kind of reminded me, we were just talking briefly about Dune, about Miles takes someone's notions about salvation and turns that into a running theme to get people organized to actually follow his directions to destroy the anarchy in the camp and replace it with an order with him kind of on top, but really just running things behind the scenes.
Yeah, he's really not quite on top so much as he is log rolling.
Right.
He's just a lot of log rolling.
You know, frantically treading water to keep on top of things.
But it's totally improvisational in a way that even if you're comparing him to Paul Atreides, which I think you are.
I am.
He and his mother kind of knew that the Fremen had been prompted with all of this mythology. But Miles just happened to be lucky enough to stumble across this guy, Sueger, who had decided this piece of paper that he'd torn out of a book in his last military action was scripture.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it might as well have been a page from Dune. I mean, you know? but it probably wasn't. But he took it as scripture and he had it memorized and he still had the paper. And he, you know, he gave Miles the idea. He's like, are you the other one? You know, like, I'm the one. Are you the other one? And of course, for a second, I was thinking of Zathras, but that.
Yeah.
You know, not the one. No. But I can't do Zathras as well as I used to. I can't make that clicky sound. But anyway, I have to admit, though, sometimes I found it a little implausible that people were falling in line so easily with what Miles said until I realized that everyone in this camp were military POWs.
Yep.
I'm like, okay, so they've got a lot of training and discipline already, and he's just trying to shake them back to it. But at first I was just like, it's a prison camp, you know? Who's in there? So I really liked that detail was kind of kept back, and that Miles' titular mission wasn't a huge focus. You know, he was so subtle about it. He's like, hey, there's this one guy here. I wanted to talk to him. But it wasn't like he's, you know, there's not like expository text at the beginning that's like, Miles was here to rescue the Colonel. He's just there and beaten up and naked and rolling with the punches and making shit up as he goes along. That's awesome. It's like even more Miles than the last story.
I was really taken by the fiendishness of the Setagandan.
Oh,
yeah. You just have a force shield around an empty spot. They have food coming randomly at one spot in the dome. So it's a scramble for trying to... Are you going to wait at one spot and be guaranteed, or try to see in the center? Or if people, one person gets more, then someone else gets less. It's a ripe situation for divide and rule.
But it's completely in accord with all of the rules for prisoner treatment.
Right.
You know, follows the letter of the law. Exactly.
But not the spirit.
Right.
Yeah, there
has
to be medical personnel, but they don't have to have any equipment or drugs.
Right.
It just says medical personnel. Huh. The unit's doctors are trapped just as naked as the rest of them. And then I don't know that anyone but Miles ever sussed out that this is basically just trying to break them down and inoculate them with the disease of submissiveness. And then they were going to be returned to the population and be like, yo, don't even try to rebel against these Setagandans, man. So really, Miles turned this machine for making a fifth column into a machine for making a revolution. And that is incredible.
Well, I think, you know, that may be part of why Miles was successful, aside from his mind-bending logic and amazing magnetic charm, because all of these people had probably felt themselves breaking down. No one would like to live in an environment like that. So I'm sure they all wanted some kind of order and structure. And so as soon as Miles was able to get the least little bit of momentum going for his organization, people were going to want to join in on that because most people don't want to just be anarchists. They want to have something to believe in and, you know, something to belong to.
But can you imagine if it was like an ordinary prison he tried to do this? No effing way.
Mm.
There has to be like a population with the habit of order for that to have worked.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the prison in Guardians of the Galaxy, for example.
I'm thinking of Oz.
Yeah. I went for something science fiction. And Miles trying to do that there? No. Not unless he had Rocket and Groot on the side, no. Another movie to think about this story in context is, have either you ever seen Bridge on the River Kwai?
Oh! Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect. Oh, Guinness! Perfect. Madness! Mm-hmm. Madness! Mm-hmm. Yep. having prisoners, yeah, dealt with severely by a population, kind of broken down and trying to find order in themselves. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that Bujold must have seen the movie and was inspired a bit by it.
Sure. Absolutely. That makes perfect sense. How did you like the little stinger at the end when you find out what planet the prison is on? He's back in the hospital. His mom comes in and chases everyone out. And he, you know, there's that little click. We haven't talked about Beatrice or Triss or anybody yet, but that little click, he's like, oh, no wonder I like the redhead, because here's his giant, stately, amazing mother, Cordelia, with red hair. And she says, so tell me, how was Earth?
I don't think that actually was the prison plant was on Earth. It's just he had been he had gone to Earth.
Back. Oh, or, see, I took it as the prison was on Earth.
Nope. No, the whole framing for the thing takes place after the next book in the series.
So
he's going to have adventures on Earth in the next book, Brothers in Arms.
Annoying, but okay.
Sorry about that.
No, it's the limitations of that framing story, which, as I said before, I don't like.
Yeah, that changes a few
Anyway, let's talk about poor Sergeant Beatrice.
Yes.
Oh, man. So she is a freaking Amazon. And one of the interesting things that Miles comes into is he realizes that the women that are in this prison have banded together for their own security and protection. Because at some point, it sounds like it was basically a rape camp.
Right.
Because the men outnumbered them and were just... until the women got together. And now, every time a man even comes near them, I love what happens to Miles. You know, he approaches them, and he's immediately picked up by a couple women and kind of tossed around, and then they just...
throw him away and walk him away. He, of course, being persistent, Miles refuses to accept go away for an answer, and he figures out the range that he can get close enough to without actually getting attacked. And then he just kind of lopes alongside and shouts his arguments and stuff.
Yeah. And logics his way in.
And he play acts a hat so he can pretend to be not absolutely naked.
Oh my god, that was adorable. That was so adorable. And then he turned it into this whole metaphor of, like, how you establish civilization.
Right. Can you see the plumes, the feathers on the hat?
Yeah.
When you can see the feathers on the hat, then, you know, then we're getting somewhere.
Yeah, when you can tell me what color they are.
Yeah.
and it all turns out, you know, and he's, again, this is something that isn't telegraphed, which I really like. So he's like, no, it's got to be 14 groups that we, you know, we're going to regiment into 14 groups for the distribution of food and how we move on the big pile of ration bars to take it over and fight everyone off.
It's a theologically significant number, he says.
Right!
Because someday we're all going to be ascended and we're going to rise up into the clouds. And that is his cue to Ellie and Elena, who are listening in because they've infiltrated themselves as techs on the Cetagandan side, overseeing the camp. That's his cue to Ellie and Elena. He's spouting this theological gibberish, and it's his cue to them, hey, we're not just taking this one important prisoner who sadly died before we can get him. We're going to break this whole prison camp out. It was just, you know, reading that for the first time years ago, that was just such an awesome moment of wow.
Right? And it kind of made me realize, and I'm realizing it just now, actually, Miles has done all this before because he pulled the Dendari mercenaries basically out of his ass.
Yep.
And look at how amazing they are now. So this is actually his second go around doing this, except this time maybe it's a little more literal.
It is. He starts with absolutely nothing. Yeah. And winds up getting a whole camp behind him to break out. And as you said before, change the fifth column into a resistance force. The Setagandans really dropped the ball on that. But we lost Sergeant Beatrice. I still has nightmares books later about what happens to Sergeant Beatrice or falling. Well,
it's described so intensely and horrifically just right there that I might have nightmares, man.
Yeah, I'm glad that Bujold remembers that this is a key moment in Miles' life, the fact that he couldn't save her and that it permanently affects him for a long time after. It is kind of sad. It's like, Sergeant Beatrice. It's like, I knew it was going to happen. It's like knowing the train wreck's going to hit. And just, I still have to listen to the audiobook like, oh, here it comes.
Well, and Bujold primed me to expect a last-minute save because Fat Ninny survived.
Yes.
So I was all ready for, I was emotionally primed for an exhilarating, terrifying near miss. Oh, shit. No, she really died. God damn it. I almost want to just try and find it in my book right now and read the passage aloud, but it's... You know, guys, just if you haven't read the book, you've got to read it. The description just killed me.
Well, listeners, I see a dropship coming down from orbit. I believe it's from the Andari fleet. And coming out of the dropship would be Stina Lights, who has come to join us for the remainder of the podcast. Hello, Stina.
Hello.
Hello. Yeah, you're just in time to hear the most harrowing passage in the whole book. Do you want to know what it is, or do you just want to be hit with it like a ton of brick?
No. Let me know what it is.
Okay, we're talking about Beatrice.
Beatrice?
Yeah, at the end of Borders of... Not quite the end.
Yeah! Red-headed Amazon of Miles's dreams.
Yeah. I thought that was pretty clever, the way she did that. You know, that he didn't put it together that she reminded him of his mom to a certain degree.
I love that too.
Yeah, that was so well done. But yeah, that was so sad.
It is. And I thought it was so well written that I was just going to read a bit of it.
Go right ahead.
Okay. Well, to set it up, they're trying to get on the last ship. And by the way, another Dendari mercenary has just bitten the dust because there's a sniper shooting a plasma rifle, and it slices off Mirka's head and burns a little damage into the on-ramp that they're using to get into the ship. And so when they board the ship, they're still maybe a little shocked from losing Mirka, or at least Miles is, and the ramp won't close. And so they're going to have to jettison the ramp. And, he was trying to do it one way, and Beatrice yells at him and says, "You'll never get it that way." To a chorus of shouting, thumping, and swearing, the shuttle lurched abruptly onto its side. Men, women, and loose equipment tangled across the tilting deck. Beatrice kicked bloodily at a final buggered bolt. Final buggered bolt. The ramp tore loose at last. Beatrice, sliding, fell with it. Miles dove at her, lunging across the hatchway. If he connected, he never knew, for his right hand was a senseless blob. He saw her face only as a white blur as she whipped away into the blackness. It was like a silence, a great silence in his head. Although the roar of wind and engines, screaming and swearing and yelling, went on as before, it was lost somewhere between his ears and his brain and went unregistered. He saw only a white blur, smearing into the darkness, repeated again and again, replaying like a looping vid. So that basically, that must be what all of his nightmares are later on, right? I mean, basically, she just wrote his nightmare. Oh, broke my heart. Because Miles is just never going to get the girl. Okay.
Spoilers! Okay, spoilers! Right, okay. Spoilers!
Right. I'm the newbie.
You're the newbie.
But that's the emotion I have right now. We barely knew Beatrice. Miles just adored Beatrice.
Well, you know, how often... Think about your own past. Did your first love work out?
No.
No.
Yeah. No. Nor mine.
Nor did the second.
Yep. Nor the third. Yeah. Or the fourth. You know, it's just, in my opinion, it was smart that it wouldn't be realistic if it worked out the first rattle out of the cereal box. You know what I mean?
True.
Well, at least it was a heroic action death. It was not someone that Miles just tried to save and failed. She saved him and the rest of the shuttle. And died doing it, but, you know, she was not a damsel. She was the hero there.
Exactly. And I love that about that story.
We haven't really encountered a lot of damsels in these books. All the princesses so far have seemed to be pretty self-rescuing.
Funny how that worked.
Right? You'd think a lady was writing me.
For something. Yeah.
But you know, one thing I was looking forward to them addressing, and they never did, because the other big female character in this story, Triss, who is one of the two that Miles is groomed to lead the revolution, Triss is usually a nickname for Beatrice. So I was waiting for them to be like, hey, Beatrice, Triss, you guys related? You know each other? Huh? And we never got that cute little moment.
I never made that connection.
I did right away. I'm like, are you her mom? I was waiting for something like that. Because, you know, Triss was like the leader of the, you know, the Amazons under the dome. And Beatrice was a lieutenant, kind of. But on the other hand...
I thought that they were the same person.
You did?
Oh.
I didn't.
Well, I was wondering that a couple times, but then when I knew for sure, because Triss and Suegar go up in an earlier ship, because Miles wants to make sure. Because then at one point, when one of the ships gets blown up, Miles is like, oh shit, is that one of them? So that definite, because otherwise I could see where it could actually, they could be the same person, but it's definitively settled there.
Yeah. And there's, I found the spot where first meet, last line is such good writing. Illusion had been burned out of her like an infection, leaving a cauterized scar. Rage burned permanently in her eyes like a fire in a coal seam, underground and unquenchable. Unquenchable. Like, yeah, Triss is not to be messed with.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I love that.
So what other reactions did you have to these three novellas, Stina?
Well, for me, I really enjoyed the first two, though. The last one was pretty hard going for me because it was just so raw. You know what I mean? I really liked how the death of the baby was handled, how he decided that the little girl baby was his. He was going to do everything for her, that she was the one that he was going to do everything for, to make changes for.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was like, oh, man, that's brilliant. I love that. That was just so cool. And then I don't remember the other story.
So I just found a passage that confirms y'all are right and I am wrong, because there's a line where Miles says, Beatrice, would you please go get Triss and Oliver for me? So I've read that story at least three times.
Oh, no.
And got them confused every time. Miles's amazing cast of supporting characters is a little hard to keep track of sometimes.
Right. But I like that we're not so artful that we don't ever have similar names. You know, it's because, you know, sometimes you do meet two ladies named Trish or whatever. So
I can't remember what the other story was.
Labyrinth. That was his whole story with the werewolf.
Horny teenage werewolf. How could you forget that?
Right. How could I forget about the horny teenage werewolf? I thought he handled that one pretty well, frankly. I like that.
Handled?
Did you?
I'm sorry. I'm 12. I said handled.
Well, you know what I mean. I thought that was very mature of him, the way he dealt with the situation. It could have, me personally, I don't know how I would have written that story if that story had showed up on my doorstep. I don't know how I would have done it, but I do like the way it worked out. I really like the way it worked out, that he was like, well, you know, we did have sex, but that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, happily ever after, but, you know, I respect you, right, and I want things to be good for you, and I will set everything up nice for you.
And then she points out, hey, we haven't done all the paperwork. You're not my supervisor yet, so it's not
yet.
And so the implication is they basically banged all the way home.
Yeah. Of course.
You know, as long as everyone's clear-eyed about it, hey, why not?
Why not? Yeah, I thought that was pretty cool. But yeah, the under the dome thing was really, that's a really raw, emotional one. And it's so well written in that regard. And I so appreciate that. She's an amazing writer, I gotta say. But that's my opinion on those.
That's good. That's very good. Thank you. So now that Steen has given her overall thoughts, how about the two of you give your final thoughts on the Threes novellas, starting with you, Trish?
Well, none of us really love the framing device, but ignore that. Just, you know, it's as three separate novellas, all the novellas are great, and they are worth anybody's time to read. And as I said before, I just love how everything ties together and flows back and forth in time with references to things that have happened in the Vorkosaverse and side players and small things that you think are just beautiful in this story, and they are, but they're going to come up again, so you get to experience wonderful things again. So it's just anyone who hasn't read these, who's at all interested in the Vorkosaverse, should.
Kate?
I was getting the last book, Setaganda, really, I was kind of starting to lose a little enthusiasm. And it was you guys that were keeping me going through the series. Because, you know, there's a lot of books out there. Look at my Kindle and all these things that I've acquired and haven't read yet. But these novellas sucked me back in hard. They were exactly what I needed. They really distilled what makes Miles such a great character. They really emphasized how rich the world building is and how there's so much more left to explore. And they were very different, but they still had that enough, you know, the framing story aside. I didn't mind the framing story that much, except for Stina, you were gone, but I took that last bit about how was Earth to mean that the dome had been on Earth. And I was just like, how was Earth? Oh, yeah. You mean the prison? So that misled me a little, but I kind of got a kick out of the whole justify the cost overruns thing. Because if there were ever any cost overruns that you could call justified, I think it would be that mission. Because morally, it was questionable. Anyway, we're going to rescue one guy and leave all those other people in horrible, nasty bondage? No! So, yeah. Because, you know, we'd set an expenditure, we'd set a budget for rescuing one guy, and we're going to leave all these other people. No! So, I didn't mind the framing story.
I didn't mind the framing story at all, either, because it just made the whole justify yourself, and you mm-hmm. went over the cost over. That is so standard military, I think.
I've never been in the military, but I've been a politician, so I understood that end of it very, very well.
Yeah, I've never been in the military, but I've dated someone who was, and just looking at it from an outsider's perspective, that close, that's just so typical.
Well, it's awful being the one who's having to ask these questions too. But I understood where Ilya was coming from too.
He's an auditor. He has he's got a mind the beans, and even if the beans are spent in a good cause, Miles spent an awful lot of extra beans on these ventures.
And now he knows where the beans come from. You know, he's been up among the hill folk that right. are paying the taxes.
Yep.
Exactly. So, I liked that aspect of it, too.
Yeah, these are really amazingly meaty stories. I am in awe.
I'm glad after our relative disappointment with Setaganda that we're back on board, because next time on Reading Rangers is Brothers in Arms.
Oh, and I think that's one of Alex's favorites, huh?
Yes. So,
and not just Alex, it sounds like.
So I hope you enjoyed this episode of Reading Rangers, listeners. Stay tuned as we continue going through this sector of the galaxy that is known as the Vorkosiganverse. And I want to thank the three of you for coming on tonight. Thank you, Trish.
You're welcome. Love to talk about it.
Thank you, Kate.
Thank you, Paul. This has been fun.
And thank you for coming in on the dropship, Stina.
Well, thank you so much for making space for me. That was very nice. I really like talking about these books.
There's always space for you aboard our ship, baby.
Aww.
And with that, listeners, stay frosty. And see.
Yay! Yay!
Thank you for listening to the show. If you'd like to support us, you can find us at patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can do so at our email at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com, on Twitter at skiffyandfanty, and on Facebook at The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro and outro music comes from Dimension by Creo. You can find out more about them at freemusicarchive.org.